I want to welcome you to this Americans for Peace Now briefing call with Ian Black. He's the Middle East editor of The Guardian, joining us from London. I'm a longtime personal friend. I met him in Jerusalem in the early 1980s when he covered the Middle East for The Guardian out of Jerusalem. He has more than 25 years of experience covering relations between Europe and the Middle East for The Guardian in various capacities. And I therefore thought that it would be uniquely positioned to analyze the recent policy directive regarding the West Bank settlements. Since we scheduled the briefing call last week, Secretary of State Kerry announced the resumption of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. Today, the European Union announced the inclusion of Hezbollah in its list of terrorist organizations. I will ask Ian to talk about all these and more. And because so much is happening, Ian has informed me that he will have to leave us on the half hour. This is going to be a shorter call than usual. I'm sure, Ian, that like others, you are holding your breath, expecting the news from St. Mary's Hospital in London about the royal baby. But we will ask you to divert your attention just for a while to back to the Middle East. Just a couple of quick housekeeping notes before we start. The conversation is recorded. If you're interested in a link to the audio file, please email me or my colleague Catherine Cunningham at Peace Now. Catherine is at kcunningham@peacenow.org. All the participants are currently on mute, and you will remain on mute unless I unmute you. If you'd like to ask a question, you dial 5-star. You've done this before, I think, so 5-star to ask a question anytime during the conversation. You can do it now or during the Q&A part. You will hear the words hand raised, and then you will know that you have been registered to ask a question. Once you hear something like line opened or something like that, you will know that you're next in line to ask a question. Again, I will not belabor this. I'll just remind you how to do that when we reach the Q&A. And without further ado, Ian, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Uri. Very nice to talk to you, and hello to all of you there, wherever you are. This is by way of just a brief introduction. As ever with the Middle East, there's a lot going on. It's unfortunately why I have to slightly curtail this talk. I mean, when we first discussed this, about a week ago, Uri and I, we were talking about the EU decision on the guidelines on settlements, which seemed to me and still seems to me to be quite a significant move in the wider picture. Of course, in a sense, that's been superseded in the news by Secretary Kerry's apparently successful mission to convene the next round of Israeli-Palestinian talks after such a long gap. But there are lots of other things going on, too. We've had, as I mentioned, the EU decision on Hezbollah, which is another part of the mix. It's worth dwelling on that a little bit. I mean, my focus is, it can be whatever you want. I think that for Americans, it's always interesting to look at the role of the European Union, an important organization to Europeans, but not appreciated and not understood very much elsewhere, perhaps. And just in the space of a few days, it's done a couple of quite important things. It might be interesting to talk about that, why that's happening, and what the motives are, how it fits in with what U.S. Diplomacy is trying to achieve. Then, of course, in the background, it's been an incredible, what is it now, 2.5 years of the story, the phenomenon of what we initially, perhaps naively, called the Arab Spring. Maybe now it needs a more designation, taken the big picture of events, Syria in particular, and the extraordinary developments in Egypt. So I think that I, having just touched on those points by way of reference, I should make myself available to you, and please feel free to ask me any questions. I'll do my best to answer them. Okay? Away you go.
Great. Thanks, Ian. Maybe I'll start with a quick question for you. In Israel, particularly the more conservative circles in Israel, have been depicting the EU's decision on settlements as an attempt to appease Europe's growing Muslim minority. Do you agree with that? I know that you have written about the fact that, that this also stems from public pressure in Europe, but is that a fair depiction?
I think it's a very partial depiction, and I think it's one that slightly depressingly shows, I think, the gap between, you know, Israeli perceptions and wider perceptions. I don't think that European governments, another worth remembering, there are 28 members of it, really respond to demands from growing Muslim populations. First of all, it's a very different situation. You know, France, for example, has a large Muslim population. That's certainly not true of the new Eastern European countries used to be behind the Iron Curtain. It's a generalization, I think one based on a slightly crude characterization of political motivation as stemming from a sort of religious or racial basis. What I think is true as a generalization is that public opinion in European countries, and particularly in Western European countries, is far more sympathetic these days to the Palestinian narrative than it is to the Israeli narrative. And I think you can see that very clearly in the growth of that movement for BDS, boycott, disinvestment, and sanctions. Of course, BDS is not supported by any governments as such. And I would argue that part of what we've seen happening in the EU is a governmental response to impatience with an untenable status quo over Israel and Palestine. But actually, in order to stave off more radical kind of measures that might have support from the grassroots. So I don't think it's about appeasing Muslims. It's true there are more Muslims in Europe these days than there were 30 or 40 years ago, but I don't think there is sufficient force to create a political change of that kind. I think there is a wider disillusionment with, impatience with the old arguments about Israel and the Palestinians. After all, you know, 46 years since the 67 war, which most people on either side would agree, whatever else they might be able to agree or not agree on, was a highly significant moment in the modern history of this conflict. I just think over time, the European sympathy for the old Israeli narrative has borne very thin. I think in broad terms, the decision on making a distinction between Israel and 67 borders and the occupied territories is a reflection of that. It's not in itself new. It's a bureaucratic application of a decision which was made some months ago and reflects that wider change.
Thank you. I'll remind our participants that in order to ask a question, they should dial 5-star. 5-star will signal to me that you'd like to ask a question. Ian, one other thing that you have been writing about is the EU's wish to become a player and not just a payer in the Israeli-Palestinian relations, or in Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking, rather. How does that play out? What kind of role do you think, more specifically, the European Union would like to play?
I think first of all, it's worth saying that the European Union, again, perhaps particularly for Americans, is not sufficiently well known. I mean, it's very unpopular in Britain as well, it has to be said. You mustn't get the idea that everybody who is a citizen of a European country is enormously keen on what the European Union does. That's far from the truth. But nevertheless, the fact is that, you know, 28 countries, over 400 million people, have collectively an aspiration to play a larger role on the world stage, something at least commensurate with their economic weight. And there's always been a sense, I think, in if you look at the European Union, or before it was the European Union, it was a more modest European economic community. It's grown in ambition, but there's always been a sense that it was an economic giant. Well, perhaps it doesn't look like a giant these days with terrible economic problems from Spain to Greece and so on, but nevertheless, in terms of its its size, it's a substantial part of the world economy, but its political influence is not that of a giant. And in foreign policy, from the mid-1990s, particularly after the wars of Yugoslavia, the dismemberment of Yugoslavia and the wars over Bosnia, Croatia, and so on, that we all remember, there was a sense that it needed to do more to get its act together to be a bigger player. It already had NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which most Western European countries were members of, dating back to the Cold War. And after the end of the Cold War, and all those new countries coming in from the Cold, it wanted to do more. And it applied that ambition, wanted to apply that ambition to the Middle East, which is, after all, its near neighborhood. The Middle East is far closer to Europe than it is to the United States. If you're, an Italian or a Spaniard or a Frenchman, it's really not very far away at all. And, of course, the same considerations of oil and strategy apply to countries which are further away. So there's been that ambition. And, frankly, the results haven't been very impressive, partly because of the dominance of the U.S., partly because of divisions between Europeans, and partly because of a lack of trust. It's certainly true to say that Israel has never had much time for Europe as a player in the region. It's very easy to dismiss it as old colonial power seeking to have influence where it doesn't really deserve it anymore. But specifically, since Oslo, the European Union has done a lot in cash terms to support the Palestinian Authority. And as the Oslo process has withered, I won't say died, because that would be a controversial thing to say, but we all know that the Oslo process is not in great shape. The Europeans, I think, have chafed at being the people who pay a lot of money for this part of the jigsaw, but don't really have the influence that they think is commensurate with that. So that's what I mean to say when they want to move from being a payer to a player. And I think in this decision on settlements, for the first time, people have really sat up and taken notice that there are things that they can do which might actually have the ability over time to change the status quo.
Thank you. Our first question comes, traditionally from Frank Bamberger. Go ahead, Frank.
Thank you very much, Mr. Black. How do you see the Kerry initiative? How do you interpret it? Does it mean what we hope it means?
I have to confess that I have not been following that closely what Kerry has been doing. I've observed that he's been doing it, and I've observed that there's been this tremendous effort to try and get something to work, these endless trips, four, five, six trips that he's made in the last few weeks alone. To me, in the big picture, I have to say I don't have detailed knowledge of what's going on. From looking at it in the media and even talking to people who are should be better informed, I think that what is actually happening is not entirely clear, except that a very significant effort is being made by still the most powerful diplomatic player in the region to get those talks started again. But I say that I haven't been following that closely because it partly reflects a sense that I think many people have of a growing skepticism about whether there is a process to be resumed. I think over the last couple of years in particular, everybody who knows about and cares about Israel and Palestine has become more pessimistic than before in a sort of sense because of the parameters that everybody is quite familiar with, whether it's the fateful division between the PLO and Hamas, or whether it's the increasing the rightward drift of Israeli politics as shown by the last election, or whether it's by those dreadful things, those facts on the ground, those perhaps irreversible facts on the ground in terms both of concrete reality and of political perception, that the two-state solution is perhaps not going to happen because opportunities have been missed. So what I've observed in Kerry is this tremendous effort being made to convene, to go back to the best point where people were before, and to see if something can be snatched from it. I remain fairly pessimistic about the prospects because of the reasons I've referred to. But it is heartening, I think, that certainly for people, and I include myself amongst those who believe that the only solution, if there is a solution to the conflict, remains a two-state one, that the United States is having what looks like a determined push for it. But the prospects, I think, are not great.
May I ask another question, please?
Sure, go ahead, Frank. That's fine. Yeah.
Do you see the European Union now or in the future taking a position on Palestinian reunification, that is, reunification between the Palestinians and Hamas, between the PA and Hamas?
I think there are some countries which would like to talk more openly to Hamas than they do. But I observe that, collectively at least, there isn't the appetite for that. I mean, this is a subject of much journalistic attention. Discreet, secret, clandestine contacts between governments and Hamas. I think there is quite a lot of that, but it's still pretty much below the radar. There's a couple of countries. Norway, I think, funnily enough, which isn't a member of the European Union, is one. I can't think of who the other one is off the top of my head. There are some countries which openly talk to Hamas. Members of the EU don't. I think they do so in discreet ways. I think that we're in the same position that we've been in for quite a long time, particularly when this latest Kerry initiative appears, rather surprisingly perhaps, to be going somewhere, is that the Americans are saying, look, don't make things more complicated than they already are. Don't give ammunition to comfort to Hamas at a time when we are desperate. I mean, I'm making this up, but I think this is the kind of thing that is probably being said. When we're desperate to coax the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, back into talks with the Israelis. And of course, any hint of open contact with Hamas would be a red rag to an Israeli bull as well. So it would upset the apple cart too much, I think, to be doing that. But the argument that you'll be very familiar with says, look, if there is no progress in reviving the peace process, if nothing can be done, then one of the things that has to happen is, it has to happen anyway, some people would say, is that there has to be some sort of Palestinian reconciliation so that that element, that missing piece of the jigsaw, the absence of unity amongst the Palestinians, can be addressed. Because without it, it's hard to see what progress can be made. Imagine that Secretary Kerry does make progress in bringing the parties to the negotiating tables. It's fairly certain, as they've been doing from the start of this latest flurry of activity, that Hamas will be saying that it has no legitimacy, that Mahmoud Abbas doesn't represent anybody, and so on and so forth. So I think that Palestinian reconciliation is going to have to happen at some point. It seems to me that it's unlikely to happen now at the instigation of Europeans, who will not want to be seen to be undermining what everybody agrees are fairly fragile prospects for anything much coming of this latest round.
Thank you, Ian, and thank you, Frank. We're trying to expedite this call because I promised Ian that we'll let him go in 10 minutes. So if you'd like to ask a question, signal it to me now by dialing 5-star. Our next question comes from, I think it's Charlie Weiss in New York. Is that correct, Charlie? Charlie Weiss? No?
No, Peter Weiss.
Oh, it's Peter Weiss. I'm sorry. I thought it was a different Weiss. Go ahead, Peter. Sorry about that.
Mr. Black, I understand that the recent statement by the European Union is restricted to trade between the settlements and the Union directly. How do you see the chances of the Commission coming out with a further statement that would be binding on the 28 members? Or, for that matter, how do you see the chances of some of the 28 members themselves adopting a similar policy?
Well, this has the potential to be quite a complicated answer because, of course, in the European Union, you have the very important question of who decides what. What you had the other day with the guidelines on settlements, let's call it for shorthand, was quite a simple point about making a distinction between Israel and its 67 borders and the occupied territories. Now, that was a set of guidelines that is of limited application. It doesn't in itself apply to trade. It applies to EU institutions which are dealing with Israeli entities. And the point there was to make that clear distinction between Israeli entities within the 67 borders and those beyond it. And those beyond it would not be eligible for cooperation, funding, scholarships, and so on with EU bodies unless there was some clear declaration that they were inside Israel, inside the 67 borders. But the importance of that, I think, is of a marker, is of a signpost of things to come. In parallel and separate from this, there are movements in quite a few individual European countries that you'll be familiar with this issue of the labeling of goods from Israeli settlements. That is to say, if apples are being produced from the orchards of a settlement in the West Bank, they should not be subject to the sort of advantages, tariffs and so on, that apples grown on a kibbutz in the Galilee, for example, are. It's to make that distinction. Now, it's a technical thing, but it's also, as you can see immediately, a very political one. I think the issuing of those guidelines is a signpost to what may happen in future. It seems to me, and to most of the people I talk to who are familiar with this subject, that you have a process. It's a process in which Europeans have become increasingly unhappy with the status quo, with an Israeli narrative which says, yes, yes, we're ready for peace, we want peace. But its actions on the ground in terms of a settlement activity appear to belie that. And, of course, Palestinians see a continuing, a ceaseless process of the loss of their land, which they see in a continuum that goes back to 1948 and before that. The Europeans, I think, are saying this is what we believe should be, these are the contours of a just settlement of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. It's a dynamic situation. Tzipi Livni, now very much in the news again because she's going to be the chief negotiator with the Palestinians, said this herself very recently. She said, look, boycotts, sanctions will begin with the settlements, but don't fool yourself. If there is no peace process, if there are no negotiations and no outcome, then the punishment and the sanctions will extend to the state of Israel as a whole. And I believe is a direct, is an accurate description of the way things are moving. And the European move is designed, I think, in a positive spirit to reinforce the need to have a two-state solution and to make that crucial distinction being lost now over so many decades between Israel and the territories it occupied in 1967.
Thank you, Ian, and sorry again, Peter, for the mix-up. What I will do now is, because we don't have much time left, I'm going to ask two people to ask questions one after the other, and then I'll ask you, Ian, to address both. So the first question will come from Ernie Bogan.
Thank you, Rory. I'd like to get a little more specific about a particular area. Because EU support is so important to numerous institutions of higher learning in Israel, aside from the new university at Ariel, do you see any of the other universities being affected by the sanctions? I'm particularly concerned about Hebrew University being in Scopus, where it is.
Okay, so academic boycott, and then the other question will come from Avi Gordon.
Robbie Gordon.
Sorry, go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to ask, what was the role of America in the decision of the European Union to boycott all the stuff that's coming from the territory?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last bit.
What was the role of America in the decision of the European Union about the boycott of Israeli goods that comes from the occupied territories?
Okay, so two questions. On the universities, I don't know. I simply do not know. What I do understand is that Ariel, you mentioned the university in Ariel, is a clear and a quite a simple example of the kind of institution which would be hit by the application of the EU guidelines. It's not in Israel. It's quite clearly in the occupied territories, and it would therefore not be eligible for, you know, whatever kind of EU program might be available for the State of Israel. Where I think it gets complicated is that is the distinction between institutions and individuals. So, for example, if somebody, let's say, for argument's sake, is studying, is a resident of Maale Adumim, but studies at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, then I don't think that any restrictions would apply. And I think it has to be said that the actual impact of these regulations, which have attracted so much attention, I don't think will be very great. I think that their symbolic importance is far more important than any practical effect. But the symbolic and political importance of it, I would argue, is unmistakable and important. And I think that's been captured if you look at the response to it in Israel, where some of the language used has been, you know, one official described it as an earthquake. Netanyahu went on to make a statement on TV, I think live on TV, to talk about how it was unacceptable that anybody would dictate, anything to
Israel borders. Yeah,
people,
yeah.
Borders of Israel. The reaction was very, very powerful. If you consider that on the face of it, this was no more than just a rather dry series of regulations agreed in a committee room in Brussels. It's the political significance of it that matters, as I said earlier, as a signpost of what could happen in the future. The other guy, the other questioner, you say what was America's role in this decision on a boycott? Well, there isn't any. There isn't a boycott of anything. Right now, what there is, as I hope I've explained, it's a series of guidelines which are designed to create a distinction between Israel and the occupied territories. Did the U.S. have any role in this? I believe the U.S. would not have wanted anything to take place which would have been seen as undermining the latest Kerry initiative. But, you know, I think it's the kind of thing where Europeans want to make a point of their own and will do things even if the Americans don't like it. And I don't think it's an unhelpful thing to do. I think that a reminder from the EU of that distinction between Israel and the post-67 territories is an important one. And if we look at the parameters of what's likely to take place in any negotiations that Secretary Kerry manages to relaunch, I think we're going to get to the 67 borders one way or another fairly quickly. So, but I think even if the Americans didn't want it to happen at this time, which is obviously they would say is a delicate one, I think that the EU making that point is, for all the technical nature of the decision, is, as I say, a politically significant one.
Ian, one more quick question, if you may. We have Aaron Mann waiting patiently in Washington. He'll be the last one to ask the question. Please go ahead, Aaron.
Thanks, all right.
With us? Yeah.
Mr. Black, how do you see the EU's role going forward in these negotiations? Also, we haven't heard much about the quartet and Tony Blair. Do you anticipate any kind of increased role there?
I think past experience shows that this is where we get back to that question of, you know, the EU and its aspirations to be a player more than a payer, than just a payer. In the past, it's been disappointed by this. Of course, it has a role institutionally in the quartet, though, you know, certainly viewed from Europe, I don't think anybody thinks that Tony Blair, as the quartet representative, has been a resounding success. I think the perception in Europe, I generalize here, but the perception is that Blair has been over-attentive to Israeli needs and not sufficiently attentive to the bigger picture. Too indulgent of Israel, perhaps, I think, would be the perception. I expect that if these talks get underway and there's any serious process involved, then the EU will want to play a role. I expect this talk, is there not, in the Kerry initiative of a new financial package and support of the Palestinians. I expect that the EU would be expected to be part of that, and I expect, in terms of its own, you know, its own self-image and pride, it would want a seat at the table. The precedents haven't been great, but maybe at this point, if this does get off the ground against this, I think, fairly bleak background and low expectations, then I suppose anybody of goodwill will be wanting to do what they can to help. But I think a lot depends, everything depends in a sense, on how much progress there is going to be. And, you know, I just end by saying that the obstacles are still fairly formidable. Anybody who can do anything to help, I guess, would be welcome.
Great, Ian, thank you so much. I really appreciate your finding the time to brief us. As promised, 2 minutes after the half hour. Thanks for joining us. Go back to work. And I also thank everyone else who joined us. Thank you, Ian. Then that ends our briefing call, and please join us for more briefing calls in the future. If you'd like a recording of this call, please email Catherine Cunningham at kcunningham@peacenow.org. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.